Hello and welcome to Savor, production of iHeartRadio. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about cream cheese.
Yes, cream cheese, which came up in our episode we did on imitation crab.
Right, because we were talking about crab rangoon.
Yeah, and I really got into the history of it. And I mentioned that in passing in that episode. And a lot of you wrote in and said, please do cream cheese. So ask and you shall receive.
Uh-huh,
eventually,
yeah.
As we always say. But
well,
we
yes.
do have a running list.
It is promise. A long list. A yes. long disorganized list. But
it is quite disorganized.
It is a list.
And it's interspersed with things like Five Nights at Freddy's. Which aren't food things, because I really wanted to record you playing that, and I now have that on VR, and it's terrifying.
Oh, no. Okay. Oh, I'm like low-key already terrified by VR all the time, so.
Yeah. Oh, great. I can only play it for like 5 minutes at a time, and then I have to stop. But about cream cheese, I'm pretty meh on cream cheese.
Yeah.
It can be great sometimes. Like, sometimes I really, really want it. I'm really craving it. And I know sometimes I've had it and been just so surprised by how good it is. Huh. So maybe I'm just not getting great cream cheese a lot. I don't know. But yeah, most of the time I'm just kind of like, meh.
Huh. Yeah. Cream cheese is the sort of thing that I struggle with because I understand what a serving size is. But I also, that is less than the amount that I want to consume. But it's always so strange. If you go out and you get a bagel someplace that does like pretty proper bagels or even improper bagels, like the amount of cream cheese that I want is more than an actual serving size, but way less than they will put on a bagel for you if they give you a schmear of cream cheese with your bagel. And I don't know. It's some kind of like Schrodinger's amount of cream cheese. I like don't understand. Like
I found a whole article about that very thing you're talking about.
Really?
Why do they put so much cream cheese on bagels? So that's really funny to me that you bring that up.
Yeah. I'm always like, what do they think I am? Like, how am I supposed to consume this?
Yeah. Yeah. I do have many fond memories of, there was an Einstein bagels at Georgia Tech, where I went to school. And I think I probably only went there two or three times the whole time I was there, but I'd never been to one before.
Oh, wow.
And I remember when I got up to the front and they were like, what do you want? And I was like, what do you mean? And they're like, well, you got to choose your bagel. And then I was overwhelmed by that. And then they were like, now you got to choose your cream cheese. And there were like 24 options. And I'd never seen anything like that before, Lauren. And I was like marveling at it, like, tell me what that one was. That one.
Oh my
gosh. Tell me about this one. Everyone behind me, you know, it's like in the morning, they're like, oh. But I didn't know this world existed.
Sure. Oh, that's very sweet. There was either an Einstein's or another bagel chain, probably an Einstein's, like right at the corner in between my my dorm situation and my classes. And so that was a pretty frequent stop for me when I was in college. A pretty frequent, relatively sad stop because I was used to like a much better version of a bagel and schmear.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose speaking of CR bagel episode.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This and other opinions.
Yeah, Lauren has very, very, very strong opinions on bagels.
Mm-hmm.
And she laid them out wonderfully in that episode.
I think it was one of the only times that we've gotten like low-key hate mail. someone wrote in and was like, how dare you be this opinionated about your bagels because you are giving like people from Jersey a bad name by being this strongly opinionated. It's you. It's your fault. And I was like, yes. Wow.
You got a lot of power, Lauren.
Okay.
Dang.
You know, I like to think so.
There you go. Also, I discovered there's a Wiki Cheese.
Oh, well, that's
Wikipedia
delightful. Cool.
Fandom. For cheese, and I'm outraged that I didn't know that existed until now.
Well, you know, it's never too late to get into the cheese fandom.
This is, remember when you went down that cheese hole and you almost didn't come out? That's what's going to happen to me. How did you escape the cheese hole?
I guess eventually I started a food show where we just get to talk about cheese sometimes, but it doesn't have to be all the time. I can go off and talk about, I don't know, pastry lamination for a while if I need to.
All right. Well, if you get a frantic text later about the cheese hole, just be ready to send me on a different food rabbit hole.
No problem. I'm here for you.
Perfect.
Yeah. We can always find something else. Probably fermentation related.
Yes. As we've discovered. But I suppose for today we are talking about cheese. So let's get to our question.
Mm-hmm.
Cream cheese. What is it?
Well, cream cheese is a type of fresh cheese that's made usually from cow's milk with a high percentage of fat, or, you know, cream. It's sort of like a buttery cheese, or like a cheesy butter, maybe? It's a very thick, opaque white, sort of creamy, sticky, and just a little bit tart and a little buttery. It's not aged, or if it is, it's aged very, very little, so it doesn't have any kind of rind. And it's sold in tubs or in little foil packets in boxes, which got me thinking, is this technically a goon situation? Is cream cheese a goon product?
See,
Australia, right in.
I thought you were talking about like a hitman or something. Oh.
Like the goon? Like,
no. Yeah, I was like, whoa, I don't understand this reference.
No, because it's a bag in a box. It's a little foil bag in a box. Anyway, it's not quite a bag, and you're not like squeezing it out through a
well,
faucet, probably.
Yeah, but you could make that happen, and you can certainly open the foil in such a way.
Yeah, that you could squeeze it out.
Yeah.
You could.
Mm-hmm. You could.
Anyway, I don't know if they actually have cream cheese in that packaging in Australia. I'm pretty sure in the UK it's only in tubs, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, yeah, let us know.
Gosh. Anyway, here in the U.S., the finished product must consist of at least 33% fat and a maximum of 55% moisture. And it's made, cream cheese, by standardizing a mixture of milk and cream to the correct percentage of fat that you want to work with, then pasteurizing that to kill off any microbes that might be floating around in there, giving you a nice blank slate. Because then you're going to introduce a starter culture of lactic acid bacteria. And that's right. That means bacteria poop. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So we've talked about this process in previous cheese episodes and in our butter episodes a little bit. But basically, in order to solidify milk into cheese of any sort, you've got to convince the milk's solids and liquids to separate out from each other. And under normal milk circumstances, those solids are distributed evenly throughout those liquids in what's called an emulsion, because the solids are all negatively charged particles and the liquid is neutrally charged. So like two same ends of a magnet in the air, the particles push off of each other and space themselves out in the liquid in an emulsion. But if you add an acid to the mix, it'll neutralize the solid's charge, and then the solids will stop repelling each other and start clumping together. And it just so happens that there are a whole bunch of friendly bacteria called lactic acid bacteria that love to eat the sugars in milk, and it also happens that they excrete acids. So you add a culture of those to your milk, and they do this work for you. They also excrete flavor. In addition to the bright flavor of the acid, there's probably going to be a little bit of butter flavor in there as well. So to make cream cheese from milk, you get your creamy milk, you let the bacteria grow, the solids clump together for a little while, maybe like 5 to 15 hours, then kill off the bacteria by heating the product up, break up the clumps a little bit so that the texture of the stuff is smooth, and then strain out as much of the liquid called whey as you want by either draining it or centrifuging it. Yeah. Then you can either cold pack your cream cheese if it's going to be eaten like very soon, very fresh. Or you can hot pack it and homogenize it using some kind of stabilizer like locust bean gum if you want it to be shelf, or not shelf stable, like refrigerator stable for a couple months.
Oh.
Uh-huh. That's why many, many grocery store brands of cream cheese will have some locust bean gum or something like that in there just as a stabilizer, just to keep it fresher longer and texture-y mm-hmm. longer. Yeah. And there are lower fat cream cheese products on the market, often buffed up with even more stabilizers for texture. You can make similar products with plant-based milks for people who are avoiding dairy. You can even make it at home. It is a little bit tricky to get the texture right, but it's totally possible. And the result is smooth and spreadable. It's used as a topping for baked goods like bagels and as a creamy ingredient in both savory and sweet dishes, from a filling in like more other baked goods to kind of like a sauce binder in casseroles to a creamy element in dips to a texturizer and flavorizer in ice creams, in cheesecakes, in frostings, as a topping. It is often blended, as Annie was saying, with various flavorings and add-ins, both sweet and savory.
Yes. It's in all kinds of things when I was thinking about it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Like sometimes I don't realize how much cream cheese is in our cuisine. Here in the U.S.
Yeah, here, especially once you get into the hot dips and casseroles category.
Yeah.
It is just everywhere because it's delicious. It's fatty. It's going to make everything just creamy and great.
But okay, what about the nutrition, though?
Yeah. I mean, you know, cream cheese gets its name from cream being added to the milk during production. It's a calorie-dense food. Lots of fats in there. It also does have a bit of protein, though. You know, it'll certainly help fill you up. But in order to keep you going, I would recommend pairing it with more protein and some veg. Always eat a vegetable.
That's one of our many mottos here at Savor.
Mm-hmm.
Always eat a vegetable. For numbers, we do have some numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So the brand Philadelphia Cream Cheese accounts for about 60% of the cream cheese market. Philadelphia Cream Cheese is available in over 80 countries.
Huh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As of 2007, production of cream cheese and the related American version of Neufchâtel in the U.S. was at around 350,000 metric tons per year.
Ooh.
As of 1997, Americans were consuming about 2.7 pounds of cream cheese per person per year, which is about 1.2 kilos, which I'm impressed by.
Yeah, I'm teetering between. I can't tell if that's way more than I thought or way less than I would have thought.
right. I'm kind of like, yep. I will say that the bagel boom in the United States right around the mid to late 90s like significantly upped our national per capita consumption.
Mm.
But
the bagel boom.
Yeah. And speaking of, cheese consumption overall has been going down a little bit in the United States the past couple of years. I think just as people are a little bit more aware of how calorie dense those foods can be. But cream cheese seems to be a staple that is not going anywhere.
Cream cheese is here to stay.
Yeah. But how did we get
to
here?
How did it get here? Yes. Lauren, even virtually, we are on the same page.
Oh, yeah, we are. but yes, we will get into that history. But first, we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
So, cream cheese's predecessor, the European Neufchâtel cheese, goes all the way back to 1035, though the first record of it doesn't appear until 1543. It originated in Normandy, France, in a small village called Neufchâtel-en-Bray, hence the name. Mm-hmm. And it was a cow's cheese that was a bit harder than cream cheese, a bit grainier. It was eaten fresh or slightly aged. It had these notes of like mushrooms and nuts. It was salty, savory cheese. This is all what I got from reading articles about it. I am notoriously bad at describing how things taste, but also I've never had it. And yeah, that could probably be its own episode, but very
probably
brief.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you jump all the way ahead to 1969, this cheese was given the AOC in France, which again is sort of that like France way of saying it's only this and it has to be from here and it has to have these ingredients at this percentage and
yeah,
kind of a national designation of what that is.
Yeah, yeah. French Neufchâtel is still a whole kind of separate category. It's made with whole raw cow's milk. It's got a soft bloomed rind, like a brie or a camembert. Sometimes it comes in a heart shape, supposedly first made by French dairymaids who were trying to woo English soldiers during the Hundred Years' War.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. Traditionally made, that savory, earthy rind should encase this creamy and just slightly grainy interior that's got a little bright papalactic acid to it. Here in the U.S., I think I've only ever seen Neufchâtel like packaged the same way that our cream cheese is, and sometimes sold as like low-fat cream cheese because it's supposed to have between 20% to 33% fat as opposed to the over 33 that cream cheese is supposed to have. So, there you go. Just Americans mucking about with stuff again.
As we're wont to do.
Yeah. And also, I do love that we looked up how to say that word because Neufchâtel, because I'm pretty sure that every time I saw it on packaging before now, I've just been like confused and just my brain went, I don't know, axolotl, what? Sure, let's move on.
Yeah, your brain was just like, nah.
No, nope, unimportant.
I will say, I know we did look it up and the version we're saying is the English pronunciation. So just put that out there.
Cool.
Yeah, cool. So the earliest documentation of cream cheese goes back to England in 1583. But I couldn't find any other documentation of that other than this phrase appeared in England at that time from the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. So it probably wasn't the same thing at all.
There are a few descriptors of these types of soft fresh cheeses that run around various parts of Europe that had cows and were making cheese. For all of this intervening time, from like the 11th century up through the mid to late 16th century, and it's a little bit hard to suss out whether they were just talking about like any old soft rind cheese like this, or if it was like a specific product that we would recognize as being that today. I think it's the former. But at any rate.
Yes. At any rate, the history of cream cheese in the United States begins sometime in the 1870s with a farmer in New York named William Lawrence. Lawrence grew up working as a farmhand for his impoverished family, eventually going on to marry a farmer's daughter. And he and many of the farmers around him made Neufchâtel cheese, sending these wrapped-up rolls of it to the city. One day, this fancy grocer approached Lawrence and requested that he make a pricier deluxe version.
Mm-hmm.
So what did he do? What did Lawrence do? Essentially, he added more fat. He took curdled milk and pressed as much of the liquid out as he could and replaced that liquid with cream. And he went with the obvious name, cream cheese.
There you go.
And cream cheese did start as a high-priced luxury item well-to-do diners might request in New York City. More and more farmers started making their own cream cheeses, which impacted the price. A pound of cream cheese cost about 30 cents in 1889. In 1909, it rose to 40 cents a pound.
And it was wrapped in foil from these early days. If you've ever bought it in that type of packaging and wondered why such a weird, fussy, kind of difficult piece of packaging exists, and these are modern times, you can thank the late 1800s.
Yes, I have wondered that, in fact. Why am I struggling with this? Enter Alva Reynolds, the cheese broker.
Not to fix the packaging, but to, you know, do other stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, he's just entering this outline. he came to Lawrence with an offer to distribute Lawrence's product under the name Philadelphia Cream Cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Not because the cheese came from Philadelphia.
Nope.
Mm-mm. Because it doesn't. It didn't. But Pennsylvania, and particularly Philadelphia, was well known. They were both well known for producing the best cheeses at the time. Some of the best cheeses. So it seems like there's a lot of fraudulent marketing in cheese. I feel like every cheese episode we've done, I've been like, what?
Yeah. It's like, and then they lied to us. To get us to buy more cheese when really they just had to say it's cheese and it would have been like, cool.
I'm into cheese.
Lawrence had begun his cream cheese work in 1872, which is why Philadelphia brand cream cheese still bears that date. Really, the brand name itself wasn't used until 1880, which I guess is more like cheese marketing lies, but that's cool. Anyway.
Cheese marketing lies is the spinoff show we need.
That's our true crime. That's our true crime show.
Yes. Oh, I would be so into it. Oh my gosh. All right. Soon enough, Lawrence couldn't keep up with demand. So Reynolds went to other dairy farmers and brought them in to the Philadelphia cream cheese fold, selling all of their products under the same name. Still, not quite enough. And Reynolds started his own dairy farm. He called it the Phoenix Cheese Company. And by 1905, he was already heavily marketing his products. Mm-hmm. And Lawrence, by the way, was elected mayor of Chester, New York in 1893.
Huh.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Getting involved in local politics. Love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I read his obituary. It sounded like he also invented some other things. I was like, interesting guy.
Yeah.
In 1928, Phoenix Cream Cheese became a part of the fairly newly established Kraft Cheese Company, which I know we've touched on that in several episodes. James L. Kraft's invention of cheese pasteurization became integral to the process of making Philadelphia cream cheese. This is also around the time that cream cheese's price dropped and the first round of ads for Yankee cream cheese ran in the Yiddish press. And also around this time, a New York cheese distributor and manufacturer named Breakstones started advertising a higher-fat cream cheese to the Jewish community. Your blintzes will taste much better with Breakstones cream cheese, the copy read. Things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Breakstones, now known mostly for their sour cream and their cottage cheese products. But interestingly, brief Breakstones side note, one of the foremost experts on cream cheese out there is this rabbi, oh my goodness, by the name of Jeffrey Marks. And yeah, he's a distant relative of the Breakstones and learned that and so started researching stuff about cream cheese, thinking, like having heard a rumor that the Breakstones were the originators of cream cheese as we know it, which was untrue. But then he just got so into learning about cream cheese that now he's like invited to come lecture on cream cheese and he's like written all these articles about cream cheese. He's pretty great anyway.
Yeah, I do love when we're researching a topic and one name comes up over and over,
over
again.
Over and over.
Like the expert. Yeah. And like, just how do you become that expert where like everybody's like, he's the cream cheese guy.
Yep, get him on the line. We got to talk about cream cheese, so we need him. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, here we are mentioning him.
Love it.
Yeah, me too. The end of the 1920s and beginning of the 1930s is also when the relationship between bagels and cream cheese blossomed and cemented in the United States. Prior to that, like we discussed in our bagel episode, bagels were tougher and thinner, and the hole in the center was huge. Not really ideal for spreading cream cheese, but with wheat flour bagels, that all changed. I'll tell you that this relationship is so just cemented here.
Mm-hmm.
I found, like, researching cream cheese, I found more articles on bagels.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
They just popped up, and yeah. I wasn't looking for them. And it would be like the history of the bagel with a little bit about cream cheese.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely a like peanut butter and jelly level association here. And as I think we did talk about in that bagel episode, wheat flour was more an American thing than it had been in some of the countries where bagels originated in Europe, where rye flour would have been a little bit more likely to have been used. So,
right.
Yeah, wheat's a little bit fluffier. So,
yeah, fluffier bagel.
Yeah.
But let's step back a bit to the 1900s when we see the first recipes for cream cheese pie and cream cheese cakes in American recipe books. In 1929, cheesecake took a real step forward after a cheesecake made from cream cheese from New York, from a New York deli, won at that year's World Fair, New York cheesecake.
So. Oh, yeah. And this, I definitely want to do a whole episode about.
Yeah.
I have just a little bit of an aside. I couldn't help myself. Cheesecake might be one of my favorite. It's way up there in terms of favorite desserts. Like, it's one of the few things that I crave really hard. So brief aside, the idea of making cakes from fresh cheeses had been around for a long heckin' time. It probably came over to America with Italian immigrants, and those sorts of things go all the way back to, like, the 2nd century BCE in Rome, possibly even further than that in Greek cuisine. New York cheesecake happened thanks to cream cheese. And over the next couple decades, from 1929 into the 1930s and 40s, it would become this very popular New York City deli and diner dessert, made famous by places like Lindy's in the Theater District and Reuben's. And one Duncan Hines, who was a real person, which I did not know that thing, but cooler if I did know, I've completely forgotten it and got to be pleasantly surprised again. he published a recipe for Lindy's version in 1933. So cute. He wrote, "As I write this, gold is worth somewhere around $32 an ounce. Lindy's cheesecake, at 45 cents a slice, is somewhat less expensive, yet a good many people who have eaten at Lindy's famous Broadway restaurant consider it pure gold."
Aw.
I love it.
I think we were... when we were going to Lexington, one of our field trips, and I was, like, planning out the road trip, we tried to go to, there's a Duncan Hines Museum.
Yeah, now I remember, totally.
Yeah, one day. Sort of related to all of this, in the 1900s, Kraft started publishing recipes utilizing Philadelphia cream cheese after they purchased it in magazines, further popularizing it across the United States. These recipes range from all kinds of things. Yes, the dips, the casseroles, the cheesecakes, the stuffings. And I feel like that comes up a lot in these too, where I've just never appreciated the impact these sort of company-sponsored magazines had.
Yeah.
On our, like, cultural
on
food
our
scene.
Entire dietary, like, preference set. It's really wild.
Yeah. Yeah. I still have that banana one you let me borrow.
Oh, yay.
Yeah. Yeah. Bagels, cream cheese, and lox seems to have become associated with the Jewish community in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
As we mentioned in our, what episode was it? It's one of my favorite quotes, and I was racking my brains trying to remember. The history of the carrot cake. It must have been our carrot episode. That
makes sense. Sure. Yeah.
Is really murky, and I found this quote from a cake expert that said, like, basically, it was her Moby Dick. Like, I love, like, the mystery of the carrot cake.
Yeah.
But the first known recorded instance of using cream cheese frosting to cover carrot cake comes from an American recipe book dating back to the 1960s.
Yes, but American recipes had been calling for serving like sweet breakfast breads, like banana nut bread, with spreads of cream cheese as early as the 1930s. So I think that there was probably just some kind of like slow evolution of that type of cake and those type of quick breads and that type of frosting getting just sweeter and sweeter.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Philadelphia cream cheese was introduced to the UK in the 1960s as well. Tubs of Philadelphia cream cheese became available in 1970, and those foil wrappers most of us are familiar with, they come in those. In 1977, the company debuted Philadelphia Light.
Mm-hmm.
As we mentioned in our imitation crab episode, this whole thing of making sushi palatable to Americans, this was a big push in the 1980s. Involved a lot of cream cheese.
Oh, yes. That's still, oh man. Are you ever like reading a sushi menu and like the description of a roll and you get to that one ingredient that just makes you go, whoa, who? Yeah. Oh no. Uh-huh. Yeah, cream cheese is that for me. That's, I used to really love it.
I do find it very funny that the Philadelphia roll, which almost always has cream cheese, does not, Philadelphia cream cheese doesn't come from Philadelphia. But I suppose the name is still Philadelphia, so I guess that's legit.
It's still, yeah, it's like a pun, I guess, kind of. Yeah, because it's probably that brand, like,
yeah,
I don't know, yeah, like 6 out of 10. I will, and no shade on anyone who likes cream cheese in their sushi. You do what makes you happy. Yeah. I used to be very fond of it when I was younger. So I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It was interesting to read sort of this like nostalgic brand loyalty to Philadelphia cream cheese. Mm-hmm. And I read several articles where people were, the writer was trying to get to the bottom of why that is. And it was interesting to hear chefs say, you know, it might not be my favorite, but it's just consistent. And I know most people use it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll use it to test recipes or whatever. And I just thought that was interesting. I'd never really thought about that aspect of it before. When a brand is so, you know, that's probably what people are going to use when you say cream cheese. So you're going to test your recipes
with that. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Huh. I never thought about that before. I guess, There was this amazing, if I'm in a grocery store, I'm probably going to go for Philadelphia brand cream cheese. This is not sponsored by them. I'm just making a statement. But my preference, if I can, is to go to a deli or a bagel place and get their cream cheese that is probably sourced from some awesome dairy somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's good stuff. Well, speaking of Philadelphia cream cheese, that line introduced several new products in the first decade of the 2000s, like mini tubs, Philadelphia extra light, new flavors like garden vegetables, basil or basil. The packaging went through a redesign, just always evolving.
Always. Yes. And then, there was that whole, cream cheese tea thing that happened over the past couple years. That Asian cafe, like Japanese and Korean cafe trend of using cream cheese to make like a sort of like a foamy thick whipped topping. I've mostly seen it on hot teas, I think, but I suppose I'm not sure if it goes on cold beverages as well. I know Sweet Hut here in Atlanta has some cream cheese teas.
Oh.
I don't think I've ever had it because I was always like, I don't know if I want that. And now that I think about it, it's probably delicious. Like, I love the flavor of cream cheese. I like a good like hot milk tea. So, man, I've been missing out.
The craving of the episode. I didn't know that's what it was going to be.
There you go.
Wow. All right. Well, listeners, write in, let us know about your experiences with that.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of, that's about what we have on cream cheese for today, but we do have listener mail.
We do, but first we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor.
we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with
Listener Mail.
I'm, you know, smooth is not necessarily my thing. I did appreciate when you said I was smooth. But, you know, I gave it a try. That's how I see it.
No, I liked it. And it was kind of, you were making a gesture that was sort of like a schmear, like a...
Yeah. Yeah. I was putting the cream cheese on the bagel.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have a letter from Alicia, who has been embarking on a journey of binging all of our episodes and has been just sending us... I know we've read some of her letters before, but I love it, updating on what episodes she's seen. And her thoughts on them. So Alicia wrote about our recent re-release of the mocktail episode. This episode reminded me of the mocktail that is featured in the sixth book of the series of unfortunate events, The Arat's Elevator, the aqueous martini. This drink was essentially cold water with an olive in it. When the Baudelaire children were with Esme and Jerome Squalor, this was considered the very in drink in a fashionable society. No surprise that the kids didn't like it. Which, side note, I love that. And that is so funny. That's a very good commentary on, like, what's in.
Yes, yes.
Then she wrote about Thousand Islands dressing. I live in the Thousand Islands. This was created to be served with fish when fishing was a large part of the area. However, the town that it belongs to is wildly disputed up here.
Oh, okay.
Ooh, love yeah. It. Mm-hmm. In a barbecue episode, there was talk of eating alligator. The New York State Fair has a booth every year where you can eat alligator on a stick. Along with that, they offer wild boar and kangaroo. Once I got over the fear that Kangaroo Jack and his friends weren't going to dropkick me for eating it, I decided it was the best thing I have ever eaten. Coffee commercial. Because I enjoy your silly puns and jokes, I was a bit disappointed that the phrase wasn't, if my coffee is weak, then I am weak. Oh. But no matter. I have a new silly coffee motto for you. I grind my coffee fresh daily, and with that being said, you gotta grind those beans if you wanna grind those dreams. I love it. I'm in.
Oh, yeah.
It makes me feel like my morning cup of coffee is, like, so badass as opposed to what it is right now, which is kind of just like, oh, God, get me caffeine.
Yeah.
Please, as soon as possible.
Pour it into my eyeballs. How does it get in faster? Yeah, that's how I feel. Yeah. Hayward wrote, as a Key West resident, I was amazed how many times you mentioned Key West without giving it any credit. This Miami or Tampa thing is utter BS. Miami did not even exist, and the Tampa cigar makers moved there from Key West. As far as the U.S. goes, the Cuban sandwich was made for Key West cigar makers' lunch long before either Tampa or Miami didn't even exist. And there is no salami in an authentic Cuban sandwich. Again, that is just newbie BS.
Dang, another city enters the fray.
Oh, I love this. I love this so much. Oh, my heck. Also, I will say that my friend Cody, who is from Central Florida, told me very firmly that salami is in an authentic Cuban sandwich and that anything else is BS.
Oh, this is awesome. I love how many people are so, like... No, this is sort of the Cuban sandwiches for them. This is what it is. And that's it. And I actually responded to Hayward, and he responded back with more points.
Yeah? Oh, that's great.
Yep. Please keep those coming. We love it.
Oh, yeah. Well, we adore a strong opinion if you did not know that about us.
Yes. And you can send those to us. We would love to get them. Thanks to both of these listeners for already doing so. If you'd like to email us, our email is hello@savorypod.com.
We are also on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @SavorPod, and we do hope to hear from you. Savor is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks as always to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.